The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
Now, you're very welcome back to The Last Word with me, Frank Graney, filling in for Matt Cooper. And I am delighted to welcome John Boyne, renowned Irish author, into studio today. And of course, into The Last Word Culture Club. John has written 11 novels for adults, 5 for younger readers, as well as a collection of short stories. And arguably, his most notable work is The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, which was, of course, adapted into a film in 2008. John, how are you this evening?
I'm very well, thank you.
I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into some of your choices, but I want to talk to you about your new book, A Traveller at the Gates of Wisdom. This is a book that I bought over the weekend. It seems like a complex piece of work, and I'd imagine the work that went into it was enormous.
Yes, it is quite complex, and I think it asks of the reader a little bit, that the reader has to give something to the story. From what I have seen with readers so far, it takes about 3 or 4 chapters for the reader to fully understand the conceit. It begins in the year 1 in Palestine, and it continues through more than 2 millennia. And we moved through 52 different countries. And the idea of the book is that as the world keeps changing in technology and industry and so on, that our human emotions generally remain the same. So that, you know, what you might feel today, if you were feeling upset in some way, if you were falling in love or grieving or something like that, then it's the same as anybody at any time in history, in any place in history. So the way I've structured the book is of this narrator who... the narrator keeps changing through different countries, but the experiences that each narrator has mirror the experiences of the one before. So we're following kind of one through line of a life just through 2,000 years.
Just through 2,000 years.
Yeah, I make it sound safe. Yeah, it's a bit easy there.
And over 50 locations, as you mentioned, and finishing up in outer space in yes. 2080. Where did the idea come from? What inspired you to write this book?
Well, I've always kind of played with time a little bit in my books. My very first novel, The Thief of Time, was published 20 years ago this month. And that ran through 256 years of history with a man whose body stopped aging in his 40s. So I've always quite liked writing history and playing with the idea of lengthy periods of time in a novel. With this, the last few books I had written, Hearts Invisible Furies and Ladder to the Sky and My Brother's Name is Jessica, had all been quite contemporary. And I felt like getting back to a little bit of history and research. You know, I don't really plot in advance. So I sat down and I'd always had this idea of starting a novel with King Herod sending the soldiers out to kill the babies, the slaughter of the innocents. And I wrote that chapter thinking, I wonder where this will lead me. And, you know, it was about 3,000-4,000 words long. And I don't really know where the idea came from, but I just started to think to myself, I wonder, could I just move now? This baby has just been born. Well, what if we move him to another period and another and another? And it sort of took life in my head as I wrote it. And I wrote about 3 or 4 chapters to get the basic tone and the narrative voice. And then I put a big map up on the wall and I started sticking pins in every country as I would go through them and trying to get a balance between the two hemispheres and East and West and so on. And trying to find interesting periods of history to write about.
Ireland features at some point. Can I ask you for a bit of a spoiler alert? What period do you focus on when you're dealing with Ireland?
Ireland is, I think, around 1,000, 1,100, something like that. And it's the chapters are often done in groups of chapters. For example, there's 4 chapters, 4 countries where the narrator happens to be in prison. The particular chapter that Ireland shows up in is when he is in monasteries of different types after the death of his wife. And so he ends up in Ireland working on the Book of Kells. So because he's always a different type of artist. In some, he's a jewellery maker, a dressmaker, a poet, a writer. In this one, he's an artist. He illuminates. So he illuminates the manuscript. So that was quite fun to write. And then I think from there, he's in a Buddhist monastery in Tibet. And so on. I can't even remember it at this point. There's so many different ones.
Natural direction for the character to take. It's a fantastic book from what I've read so far. It's a really, really interesting concept and I'm looking forward to reading it and seeing how you bring us to 2080 and what the world is like in 2080 in your imagination. Let's crack on with the Culture Club and I want to ask you about the first single that you ever bought. What was it and what memories does it invoke when you play it nowadays?
It is actually a song that I still play nowadays, actually fairly frequently. It's Bright Eyes by Art Garfunkel. And I think I was about 8 years old when that came out. And the first memory that I think of is that animated film of Watership Down that it came from. And they showed it in the school that I went to, St. Olaf's in Bilali. And it was actually quite scary for an 8-year-old. Because if you remember, there's scenes where various rabbits die and predators kill some of the rabbits. And I remember being quite sort of terrified by it. There's some quite traumatic scenes in it for a small child. And of course, it's one of the great classic works of children's literature. But the song Bright Eyes is a beautiful song, I think. It's got beautiful lyrics.
Let's listen to a bit of it. This is Bright Eyes by Art Garfunkel. What about your favourite album then?
My favourite album definitely is Hounds of Love by Kate Bush, which came out in 1985 when I was 14. And it is an album I go back to time and time again. And it's an extraordinary piece of work by my favourite singer. And the B-side of that album particularly, remember when we used to have B-sides to albums? The B-side of that album particularly is so stunning because it's a suite of music which it's about a woman drowning. And it follows her through that experience of falling off a boat and drowning and then eventually being saved through 7 different songs. And it's just this wonderful introspective series of lyrics and music. And Kate Bush has really always worked on these kind of concept albums in that way. I would say my second favourite album is Ariel, also by Kate Bush, which the B-side of that one is really all set about a painter when the sun rises and just watching a sunrise and painting it, and you know, 10 songs all about that.
How important are lyrics for you then when it comes to picking your favourite songs and when it comes to the music that you listen to, given the fact that you're a wordsmith yourself?
I think the music that stays with me the most, considering I've been listening to Hounds of Love for more than 30 years and still listen to it and still find something new in it, I guess that is down to not just the music but the lyrics and just being able to put that story. She's a very storytelling kind of lyricist, and I do quite like that.
Let's listen to her telling some of her stories. This is And Dream from Sheep from The Ninth Wave. Very distinctive voice there of Kate Bush, and I can see that you're lost in your thoughts there. What about favourite band then? This is an interesting choice. Obviously, anyone who grew up in the 80s would be very familiar with these and their sounds, very distinctive sounds.
Yeah, I had to think about this one quite a bit, but I settled on the Pet Shop Boys, probably because they're the band that I've kind of stayed loyal to for more than 30 years since they first came out in, I think it was 86, with West End Girls. And what I love, you know, we were talking there about Kate Bush and her lyrics and the storytelling in her lyrics. The Pet Shop Boys are brilliant at that as well. They're very, very witty. They're very sort of Alan Bennett like in their storytelling, in their songs, and they always have been. There's an archness to them and a great sort of British wit, I think. And you know, they wrote songs about, like, say, during the Iraq War, "I'm with Stupid," you know, the Tony Blair and George W. song, which was wonderful. Actually, recently I don't know if you saw the thing in the Guardian where over the course of a couple of weeks they counted down what the Guardian had chosen as the 100 best number one singles of all time, and the song they chose as the best number one single of all time was West End Girls.
Wow.
By the Pet Shop Boys, which I thought was a brave and interesting choice. You know, yeah. Not the Beatles, not, you know, the Rolling Stones, but Pet Shop Boys.
It's timeless as well. Is it something, are they a band that you dip back into from time to time nowadays?
Oh yeah, definitely. And they still release an album every sort of 2 or 3 years. And they're still incredibly witty and sharp in their music, and always worth listening to. They have a very, very loyal following. I suppose anybody who's been around that long has to have a loyal following.
Your choice for the best gig is interesting because the man that you've chosen was actually selected by our inductee last week as well.
Oh.
And the gig in question was, John?
It was an Elton John gig in Slough, of all places,
wow.
In England, in 2015. I have to say, I don't go to gigs very much. I never really have. I'm a bit claustrophobic. I don't like being in the middle of crowds, so I almost never go to concerts. And in fact, I live just opposite Marley Park, and they have, I can never remember, it's either Longitude or Latitude. It's one or the other, but they have that every summer there, and I still haven't gone across, but I can hear the music from my garden. But anyway, so yeah, Elton John was playing there in 2015, and it was a small, intimate gig because it was a charity gig, I think, for the Olympics or something like that, and myself and a friend went. We'd been given a gift of these tickets, and it was just wonderful because it was just him and the piano. There was no band, and he just, you know, hammered out the hits, you know, for about 2 or 3 hours, and everybody was up dancing. So it was extraordinary. It was pouring rain, I remember, but
yeah.
Nobody cared. Everybody was just up on their feet.
We don't have a clip of Elton John performing in the driving rain at Slough, but we do have him performing Rocket Man live in Osaka in Japan. This is back in 2015.
Doors ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell. And there's no one there to raise them. If you did. Rocket man,
And that is, of course, Elton John performing Rocket Man. We're joined in studio by John Boyne. He is the latest inductee to the Last Words Culture Club. I want to ask you about your favourite movie, John. What sticks out for you?
Yeah, this was a tough one as well, because I'm a big movie buff and I watch a lot of movies. And I figured that a movie that you have watched over and over and over and you still love watching is the one to choose. So I chose The Talented Mr. Ripley, the 1999 movie by Anthony Minghella, based on Patricia Highsmith's novel. And I'm a big fan of that sequence of novels, those five novels about Tom Ripley. I just love those books. But I think this adaptation is one of the strong, and there's been several adaptations of that book. Alan Delon played Tom Ripley in the 50s or 60s, and there was a John Malkovich film as well. But this one with Matt Damon and Jude Law and Gwyneth Paltrow, and it's set on the Italian Riviera in the mid-century, and it's just so beautiful. The sun is shining. All the cast are at their most youthful and beautiful. And, Tom Ripley, of course, falls in love with Dickie Greenleaf and kills him in the boats and assumes his identity. But this story of a social climber, somebody who will do anything to be part of society, I used it as my inspiration for a novel of mine, A Ladder to the Sky.
Wow.
And But I was quite friendly with the film's director as well, Anthony Minghella, before he died. And it's just a movie that is just full of great performances, quite harrowing scenes, and just this complex psychopath, sociopath, really, in the central character of Tom Ripley.
We have a clip and we'll play it. This is Matt Damon's character, Tom, creeping out Dickie, played by Jude Law, as you mentioned, with his impression of Dickie's father before revealing his true intentions in coming to Italy.
Everybody should have one talent. What's yours?
Forging signatures, telling lies, impersonating practically anybody.
That's three. Nobody should have more than one talent.
Okay.
Do an impression.
Now? Huh. The only talent my son has is for cashing his allowance.
What?
Oh, I like to sail. Believe me, I love to sail. Instead, I make boats.
Stop!
Other people sail them.
It's too much. You're making all the hairs on my neck stand up.
Oh, yes, jazz. Oh, jazz, let's face it, it's just insolent noise.
Like he's here. Horrible, like the old bastard's here right now.
Good.
That's brilliant. Brilliant. How do you know him?
I met him in New York.
Marge, yes. This is scary. You've got to hear this. Meet my father, Herbert Richard Greenleaf the First.
Pleasure to meet you. Dickie's made a fine catch.
Uncanny.
I know Emily thinks so.
I don't get it.
It's uncanny.
Could you ever conceive of going to Italy, Tom, and bringing him back?
What?
I'd pay you if you would go to Italy, persuade my son to come home. I'd pay you $1,000.
Fantastic scene and a fantastic performance by Matt Damon. I could see your skin crawling there as he was doing that impression.
It's still when he does that impression, just the hairs in the back of my head stood up as well.
Let's move on then. I want to ask you about your favourite play or musical. Do you enjoy musicals? We were speaking about...
I'm gay. So what do you think?
It's a given, is it? Well, we were talking during the break there about Rocket Man, the movie, and musicals do seem to be having a bit of resurgence of late. What sticks out in your mind? What would be your favourite?
Well, this one goes back to childhood, so it's one I really love, and it's very traditional, The Sound of Music. And there's my family always tell this story that when I was a kid, when I was about 6, 7, we used to always go over to my grandparents' house every Sunday for lunch. And my grandparents had the album of The Sound of Music. And I would just run into the house. I would sit down. I would put the album. And I remember my grandfather had this fantastic pair of headphones as well. And I would sit there and I would just play the album, over and over. It was all I would do. And, I know every word of every line of every song in that show. And still, though, when you watch that movie, it's a great movie. There's some fantastic performances. Christopher Plummer as Captain Von Trapp is a really kind of intimidating presence, and quite a sexy presence, actually, in the movie.
And it's one of those that has stood the test of time, hasn't it? Like generation after generation after generation has watched this movie.
Yeah, and it was like 1964.
1964, correct.
So, yeah.
Now, you say you know all the words to all of the songs. We're going to play one here, and I'm going to expect you to sing along. Okay. This is the Lonely Goatherd song.
Oh, this is a tough one, though. That's a tough one. Yeah.
Hitting the high notes.
Yeah, and the yodeling.
This is a song by Julie Andrews.
A prince on the bridge of a castle moat heard lay, odelay, odelay.
Men on a road with a load to tote heard lay, odelay, odelay.
Men in the midst of a troubled doubt heard lay, odelay, odelay.
Men drinking beer with a foam afloat heard lay, odelay, odelay. One little girl in a pale pink coat heard lay, odelay, odelay.
She yodeled back to the lonely goat heard lay, odelay, odelay.
Soon her mama with a gleaming gloat heard lay, odelay, odelay. What a duet for a girl and goat heard lay, odelay, odelay.
John, we should have opened your mic there because your yodeling is exceptional. Well done.
Thank you.
Absolutely nailed it. That brings me back, that just reminds me, of, you know, after we played that there, that just brings me back to childhood and Christmases in my adult years as well. It's funny how music and musicals can evoke those kind of emotions, isn't it?
But also what's interesting, I think, about The Sound of Music is that, you know, for the first two-thirds of it, really, it is that musical and it's great fun with the kids and all the drama. But then it gets quite dark because when the Angelus happens and the Nazis arrive and the family are in serious trouble and risk. And I suppose it was probably, looking back, it was probably the first time I ever heard the word Nazis and, you know, got interested in things like that.
The next question was the first one that I wanted to know the answer of when we were talking about this in the production meeting. And this is your favourite book, your favourite author. What is it?
Well, my favourite author is John Irving. And I've loved John Irving's books since I was a teenager. And I remember I read The Cider House Rules when I was about 15 or 16, and I was already writing and thinking that writing was something I wanted to do. But The Cider House Rules was the first time I read kind of an adult contemporary novel that really showed me what books can do. And it's such an extraordinary story. I like that kind of Dickensian scope that John Irving writes in. And, you know, the orchards of Maine and the story of Homer Wells and the orphanage. It's just so wonderful. And I love all of his books. And he became a real mentor to me. He is a mentor to me. When I published my first novel, I sent him a copy of the book with a fan letter back in 2000. And that was 20 years ago. And he wrote back to me and we became firm friends. And over the years, we've met many times. And in fact, I have a tattoo on my left arm, which says, we are all terminal cases. You can see it there.
Well, yeah, and, he does indeed, I can tell you.
Which
he does.
Is the last line of The World According to Garp. It says, in The World According to Garp, we are all terminal cases. We mentioned Kate Bush earlier. I have one on my left arm, which is from Hands of Love. So wow. That's my two favourite singer, favourite writer. So John Irving is my favourite writer.
They obviously had that much of an impact on your life for you to actually brand yourself.
Yeah, I think as an artist, to brand myself, yeah. In fact, I showed John that tattoo in Toronto about a year or two ago, and he thought it was very depressing to go through life with that. But I thought, no, it's quite a seize the day. You know, we are all terminal cases. You may as well live every moment. But my favourite book is by a different author. My favourite book is The Go-Between by L.P. Hartley. And it's a beautiful story. It's got probably the most famous opening line, or one of them. The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. And it's just the most beautiful story of first love. You know, this young boy, he's 12, 13, and he's not very, very rich, but his friend is. And he goes to stay with his rich friend over the summer. And he falls in love with the boy's older sister, who's about 18 or 19. And he thinks that she likes him. But of course, she's having a relationship with the farmer next door and uses him as the go-between to send letters back and forth. And the breaking of his heart over that summer when he realizes this in a very painful and dramatic moment has this effect on the rest of his life. And he's never able to form relationships because of it. It's a very beautiful piece of storytelling and very moving.
We actually have an extract here from the audiobook. So we'll have a quick listen. This is from The Go-Between by L.P. Hartley.
Yet even then I did not want to touch it. Indeed, my unwillingness increased, for now I knew why I distrusted it. I looked away, and it seemed to me that every object in the room exhaled the diary's enervating power and spoke its message of disappointment and defeat. And as if that was not enough, the voices reproached me with not having had the grit to overcome them. Under this twofold assault, I sat staring at the bulging envelopes around me, the stacks of papers tied up with red tape, the task of sorting which I had set myself for winter evenings, and of which the red collar box had been almost the first item, and I felt, with a bitter blend of self-pity and self-reproach, that had it not been for the diary, or what the diary stood for, everything would be different. I should not be sitting in this drab, flowerless room, where the curtains were not even drawn to hide the cold rain beating on the windows, or contemplating the accumulation of the past and the duty it imposed on me to sort it out. I should be sitting in another room, rainbow-hued, looking not into the past, but into the future. And I should not be sitting alone.
What are your thoughts when you're hearing those words?
Well, it actually, it occurred to me that I've written quite a few books which are narrated also by quite elderly people looking back wistfully at their lives. I certainly did it in The House of Special Purpose and The Absolutist. And I suppose that probably influenced a little bit by The Go-Between in that way. Somebody really looking back with great regret and wondering what was the single moment where things could have gone differently for them.
Do you find it difficult, reading books now as a hobby, as a pastime? I know my friend and I own a restaurant in Galway, and I now find that my dining experience has changed somewhat because you're constantly critiquing. Do you find yourself doing the same when you're reading books nowadays?
I have to say I don't. I guess because I've been reading books since as far back as I can remember, since I was 3 or 4. So reading and writing were always connected to me. I was always writing and reading. But I don't read as a writer. I read as a reader. I don't read them and think, oh, that's a bad sentence. I could have done that. Or I should have done this. I think I'm pretty much able to switch off and just enjoy reading for its own sake.
Very good. Finally, then, your favourite TV show, The West Wing. What's so good about The West Wing in your opinion?
Well, I think a favourite TV show has to be one that a comfort show that you can turn on any episode at any time and you can lose yourself in it for 45 minutes or whatever. I've always been fascinated by American politics and by the presidency. Perhaps not so much in the last 4 years where I just want a break from it, but I've always been fascinated by that and the corridors of power. And The West Wing is really the best show about that. And you've got, of course, your idealistic president in Josiah Bartlett, very much Obama before Obama was, and the idealistic staffers who are all there because they want to do something positive. And it is out of a different time really now, I suppose, because it's not cynical as a show. It's really positive. And the people in it are generally good. Even the people on the opposite side, Bartlett is a Democratic president, but even the Republicans who come in and out of the show at different times are generally kind of fair-minded and decent-minded, and there's a respect between the two that really doesn't happen in 2020. And there's great humour in the show and just great performances, and so many of those actors, Alison Janney has gone on, won an Oscar since, Bradley Whitford is in every TV show ever made. They all got great starts, I think, on The West Wing. It's a wonderful piece of drama, I think.
We have a clip here of the president defending his watching of a girls' softball game.
It seems to me if the event's over by 10, then I can be back here at 11.
Yes, sir.
And you know what that means.
Yes, sir. It means you could watch the girls' softball game.
Did you just snicker when you said that?
No, sir.
Yes, you did.
Mr. President.
Thanks, Lou. When you said girls' softball game, you snickered.
No, sir.
Yes, you snickered, as if to indicate there was something wrong with my wanting to see a girls' softball game live via satellite.
Well, you seem pretty excited about it, sir. They're ready for you, Mr. President.
Thanks, Phil. I am excited about it. You come to the end of a long day, you sit back, you open a beer, you watch a sporting event. That's what men do.
They watch girls' softball?
When that's what's on, that's what they watch. It's that or a cricket match between Scotland and Bermuda. Now, I am an educated man, Charlie, but when somebody tries to explain cricket to me, all I want to do is hit him in the head with a teapot.
Good morning, Mr. President.
Good morning, Patty. So it's softball. Sacramento State versus the University of the Pacific.
Well, that's a clash of the Titans.
Now, you're not going to spoil my fun.
I wouldn't want to.
I'm going to get to the end of the day. I'm going to sit back, open a beer,
and watch girls' softball.
That's right.
Good morning, Mr. President.
Good morning, sir.
Hey, Steve. Hey, Mikey. Listen, have I gotten any of the names right so far?
No, sir, but you came damn close on a couple of them.
Okay.
That's all we've got time for. John Boyne, A Traveller at the Gates of Wisdom, is out now. It's a fantastic read, a fantastic idea. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Best of luck with it. Best of luck with all of your other projects. And thank you very much for being the latest inductee into our culture club here on The Last Word.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.